by Jillian Tong, who is McGill's assistant head librarian of rare books and special collections. Jillian is also co-author of the special volume Meeting with Books, Special Collections in the 21st Century, which grew out of the symposium Meeting with Books that I just mentioned. In addition to essays by speakers at the symposium, this volume is interspersed with a selection of more than 50 illustrated vignettes. And any of you who do not already have a copy of this absolutely marvelous book and would like one, they are at the back of the room, ready for you to obtain after the discussion if you'd like. Many of the contributors to this wonderful book are with us this evening in the audience. And so by this gathering, it's kind of like a reunion for many of the people here. The symposium and the volume which grew out of it celebrated the memory of Raymond Klavansky as a mentor, scholar, collector, McGill professor, and donor of his significant and very valuable library to McGill. The Raymond Klavansky collection was the personal library of a historian of philosophy, at once celebrated for his erudition and his role as an engaged witness of his time. The collection of over 7,000 titles reflects the entire range of Raymond Klavansky's intellectual interests, from his early work on medieval thought to his engagement with the concepts of tolerance and its importance in post-Second World War world. While Professor Klavansky may no longer be with us, his intellectual vigor and generosity of spirit live on in his wife, Ethel Gravier, who is with us this evening. Sharing her husband's love of books and understanding of the vital importance of research, Professor Gravier has given back generously to McGill for many years in support of rare and special collections. This includes a gift nearly 10 years ago when she donated her late husband's books from his private library to join the books from his McGill office. At the time, she also generously supported the cost of cataloging and preserving this collection, which has made it visible to researchers around the world. Madame Gravier, vous êtes vraiment grande amie de la bibliothèque. I now like to introduce I would now like to introduce Dr. Richard Verb, head librarian of rare books and special collections and co-editor of Meeting with Books, to recognize other contributors to this volume and who are with us this evening, and to give you some insights into the place of rare books and special collections in this digital age, and particularly here at McGill. And I think you may have.
Thank you very much. Well, I think, Anne, you've said almost everything I wanted to say. But first of all, let me welcome you here this evening. I'm delighted to see this group of people, an interested group here in Rare Books and Special Collections. And of course, this is the official launch of the book this evening, which came from the printers just before the holidays, the end of the year. I do recommend you all having a look at it. It's quite an exciting book. And I think it really brings out some of the depths and really perhaps unexpected materials that are here in our collections. I've been here now almost 30 years, and there's hardly a week that goes by that I don't have a new surprise. And I think that's true. Will be true for many, many people. There are a number of people here this evening who participated in the symposium, which I think was one of those great events that McGill sometimes manages to actually cobble together have also contributed to the volume. Some of the names, and I'm probably going to miss people, but certainly Georges Leroux, who was there, and Desiree Park. Ethel Gravier, of course, was also contributed to the volume. Julie Cummings is here this evening. Christopher Lyons from the Ulster Library and Anne Marie Holland from Rare Books and Special Collections all contributed to the author, to the volume itself, and of course the vignettes called on the talents and interests of a wide variety of people in the library, and some of those are here this evening. Some of those people are here this evening as well. Jennifer Garland, Sean Swanick, Sonia Smith, and I'm certain that I probably missed somebody else. But it's really an exciting chance to focus, highlight the materials that we have here in the McGill Libraries, and also how much they play a role in teaching and research at the university. I think I can say, in all honesty, this has been one of my primary goals in the years that I have been here, is making this material much more accessible, much more something that actually plays into not only research and but also just the general teaching experience. So I think this evening is another example of this, and I'm delighted that we're going to have what I think is a very interesting conversation. So thank you.
Thank you.
I'm now, of course, I forgot I'm supposed to invite the dean of the library.
That's okay. He works for me. I'm here mainly to welcome people. I'm Colleen Cook. I'm the dean of the McGill Library. And I feel tonight that I am very much surrounded by friends. For me, this is a party. The Klebanski collection, which we're honoring tonight, and the symposium around it, is one of those things that we call, is the product of the life of someone who was a collector. And there are those of my world who call it the sort of thing, the fruits of a gentle madness. In the sense of collectors who really are obsessive compulsive, but people like me who are librarians who have day jobs, there's no way on the planet that we can devote the hours that someone like Raymond Klebanski did to create the sort of collection that he has given us. And so we are very, very grateful for that. And it is itself an example of the sorts of things that libraries in this very changing world that we have, in the very digital world that we live in, the importance of rare and special collections in that world. And you're sitting here surrounded by all of it. And I have to thank my colleagues, people like Richard and Jillian, who and Jennifer and Chris, who spend their lives in this sort of wonderful world, dealing with the fruits of gentle madnesses. So I want to welcome you to this event. My job is to introduce these people. Jillian, as you know, is one of ours, and Alberto is
one of yours as well.
Yes, and he is one of those mad people, but he's also been he's truly I don't know, he's a book person on steroids is probably the best way that I can describe it. There was, just Googling Alberto this morning resulted in 535,000 results in 0.41 seconds, including a great picture of him in the New York Review of Books with a dog named Lucy. We won't go there. The most current article, as of a few hours ago, was from yesterday's National Post in its review of Curiosity from Yale University Press, a new work by our guest. And the Post refers to the book as absorbing and wide-ranging. One could say the same thing about Manguel. The article also goes on to say that Manguel is a supremely bookish writer who often writes about writing. A typical Manguel title is A History of Reading. He deploys an easygoing style, never condescending. He could discuss Plato, Shakespeare, Don Quixote, and Samuel Beckett in one paragraph, his tone suggesting that this is completely normal. He goes on to say, we often speak of people who are well-read. Manguel is possibly the best-read human on the planet. Some years ago, when he set up a house in rural France, he created a library to hold his 30,000 books, which he now has to figure out how to get to North America. He arouses curiosity in readers and people who hear one of his lectures. So it's tonight that this globe-trotting person, whom I recently asked just back there if when he dies he would give me his frequent flyer miles, which would be a very good thing.
Not my library, I know.
Okay. That's right. Well, maybe some of your library. In any case, it's my great pleasure to give you Alberta Manguel in conversation with Jillian Tom. This is a conversation. Thank you.
So it's a great pleasure to have you back here with us. And do tell us if the sound is all right. We didn't have it. Okay, a little more sound. Thank you. Alberto Manguel, I've read several times, does not like a lot of preamble before conversations, so we're just going to launch straight in.
Good.
That's all right. And I would like to talk a little bit about curiosity. Now, in this book, The Meetings with Book Volumes, you contributed an essay on curiosity, and you've since expanded your thinking around that and reflections into a new book that's just coming out. And I read elsewhere about your book that somebody has called this your most personal book ever. And so I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about that, about what drove you to write that book, and if that's the case, if this is a very personal issue for you.
What drove me to write Curiosity? That is to say, I've written a number of nonfiction books, mainly on the subject of reading, libraries, books, because it all started with wanting to know who I was. I define myself as a reader, not as a writer, and what does it mean to be a reader? So I wrote all these books. But then I thought the question of what it is to read, what it is to be a reader, what happens when we are confronted with books, is part of a vaster question about identity, about our role in the world, about our responsibilities towards the world. And I was curious as to when these questions came up and how were they dealt with and who gave them a shape in words, because dogma is interested in answers, but literature is interested in questions. And it is the questions that seem to be important. So it is a personal book because the questions are personal. And I introduce each chapter with an instance, a personal instance, of the appearance of the question in my life, in my childhood, my adolescence, and other moments of my life. But I hang the whole on the book that seems to me, above all books, but this is a personal opinion, the richest, the one that allows me to travel to horizons that I know I can never reach, and that is Dante's Commedia. So the questions are found in Dante, because everything is found in Dante, and then from there I take those questions on into other areas, the French Revolution, the atom bomb, problems of ecology, collecting, which was mentioned, and so on.
Okay. You mentioned there the question of who am I? And in a couple of places I've read you talk about that question when you were a boy, and you read in Alice in Wonderland, who are you?
The caterpillar asking the terrible question.
Yeah. And this was for you the terrible question. This was the terrifying question. And through this, because you started writing about reading a couple of decades ago. It came sort of late in your career when you really started focusing on that. And the process of doing that and writing about that and reflecting on it, is it a process that leads to a greater understanding of who am I? Or does it just lead to more questions about who
am I? Well, it always leads to more questions. But I hope I came to a better understanding of those questions as I kept asking them in different ways. I think the question of who we are individually, but also collectively, is the question that drives us through life, or should drive us through life. And books give us forms of the question under the guise of certain characters, of Don Quixote or Hamlet. It's not by chance that Hamlet's big question is about identity, and that Quixote is always wavering between Alonso Quijano, the reader, and Don Quixote, the character that he becomes through his reading. But going back to one of the essential classics, one of the fundamental books of Western civilization, Alice in Wonderland, the question of who are you, that you mentioned, that the caterpillar asks, is dealt with again and again in the book. And in one instance, Alice, after almost having drowned in the pool of her own tears, is confused about her identity and wonders whether she is someone else. And she says, well, who am I? And then reaches this wonderful solution. She says, I'll wait here until they call me. And when they call me, I'll say, who is it that you're calling? And if I like who they're calling, I will say it's me. But if not, I will wait until I receive another identity that pleases me. And Alice's reasoning is, as all the reasoning in the book, never completely absurd, because it tells us up to what point we are what we are told we are, especially as children, but also as adults. And I think the process of finding questions in literature is a process of disengaging yourself from the labels that are applied to you, a man, a Canadian, a writer, whatever it is that's applied to you, and finding who you are really. And this is life's journey, as Dante tells us, but Alice as well. This is the purpose of life, to come to a better understanding of our identity and of our role in the community of human beings.
That reminds me of something that you said about Pinocchio, when you said that Pinocchio never learned to become a very deep reader, and so he never understood that his life had this huge literary history. He was part of this huge literary history, and that we all are. And I like that. It's a literary history. It's not part of history, and it's not that we need to look back and go to one event and one consequence. Mm. But there's this multiplicity of possibilities, of outcomes. Of
as a librarian, you know better than anyone that a library is a place of memory. And it is not just a place of factual memory, it's a place of literary memory, of imaginary memory, which is fundamentally perhaps more important than the factual memory. Cervantes in the Quixote has a paragraph in praise of history, and he begins it by saying, "Truth, whose mother is history," and goes on. Borges uses that paragraph in a very famous story called Pierre Menard, author of the Quixote, where he invents a French writer of the 20th century whose purpose is to write the Quixote, not to copy it, not to imitate it, but to write it again. And Borges, analyzing the work of Cervantes and the work of Pierre Menard, compares this paragraph, "Truth, whose mother is history, to exactly the same paragraph in terms of words that Pierre Menard has written, truth, whose mother is history, and says, written by Cervantes, this is a rhetorical praise of history, conventional, belonging to his time. But Pierre Menard, writing it in the 20th century after Bertrand Russell, what a revolution to say that truth is not factual, but what we say about truth, that truth is history. So truth depends on what we choose to say, which is another way of saying that our reality is verbal, our reality is imaginary. We think that we know what Canada is, and we believe in those imaginary little squiggly lines on a map, and the color pink. In my atlas, Canada was always pink. But in fact, Canada is none of its history, none of its geography, but the mythology built by the native people, the Canadian writers mainly of the 60s, Atwood's survival, the work of Anne Hébert, of all the writers that we know, who have contributed to helping us ask the questions about our identity. That is the reality, and that reality exists in our libraries.
You talk about language as something, about texts, about words, as something that just, it glances over the surface of our experience, and that we connect more to parts of our experience that can't be expressed in literal terms through metaphor, through symbol, and all of that. And is that part of the reason for your attraction for the marvelous, the wonderful, like the dictionary of imaginary places?
That's a good question.
Alice in Wonderland.
Alas, language always fails us. It is the only tool we have to communicate, and it is a very weak tool. It never can do more than allude, which is why it uses things like metaphors as scaffolding to hold it up, because it alone, when I say a glass, I'm not saying the same thing that you hear when you hear a glass. So we keep saying, well, you know what I mean. Well, you don't know what I mean, because it's the words that I use to communicate my experience are always too weak, always fail me. So I am attracted to the area of the human experience that lies outside language. Wallace Stevens, in a poem, speaks of the cracks that allows black water to enter reality. And what I think he means by that is that when we speak of factual, concrete reality, there is always another part which belongs perhaps to the unconscious, belongs to the intuition of a certain experience that we have not yet had, and that lies completely outside language. And I'm very attracted to that, that we call the imaginary, the supernatural, the weird, the uncanny.
Your attraction for that, it surprises me to hear you say, because you're very attracted to that, and you're also very attracted to interesting juxtapositions in words.
Mm-hmm.
The unanimous night, for example, mm-hmm. of the
Borges, yes.
In the circular ruins. And those sort of wonderful, evoked ideas, if you can call them that, just from a brilliant juxtaposition. And you have everything that, for me, is what poetry is about, what poetry expresses, and you express that, and yet you have said that you don't have the mind of a poet.
I don't have the mind of a poet, alas. I think as a reader, you have hierarchies, and I think that for me as a reader, the supreme hierarchy in literature is poetry. And I am very aware that these definitions by genre do something that I detest, which is labeling texts. How can you say that certain texts are a poem or an essay or a fiction? However, what we agree to call poetry seems to me the ability to use words, I have to be careful here because I can sound dogmatic, but to reveal that which is left unsaid. If you write a story, if you write an essay, however feebly, with the weak instrument of words, you try to put a story together, you try to put an argument together, but with poetry, you simply allude to an experience that lies outside language, and so you touch upon it with words, but it is never completely there. When, for instance, Emily Dickinson says, presentiment is that long shadow on the lawn, indicative that suns go down, and warning to the startled grass that darkness is about to pass. Now, if you wrote an article, an essay about presentiment, if you wrote a story about presentiment, such as, Lord Mountdrago by Somerset Maugham, you construct a narrative, whether it's an essay or a story, that has a sequence in time and has a place in the setting of the story. But Emily Dickinson's poem is none of that. It seems to tell you without doing more than building a verbal image everything that you need to know about presentiment. And that is an ability that I certainly don't have.
I'd love to see you try. You've talked also about the fact that in the past decade or so, you have felt something of a, not a liberation, that would be the wrong word, but an independence, a sense of independence and responsibility for what you write, since you've had a bit more space, your move to Mondrian, and that since a given moment in time, some time ago. And since in that same time period, I've noticed that you've written in more fiction. Your first novel was in the 90s, but since 2000, there's been more fiction coming from you. And is that a function, do you think, of having more space and being in a place, or is that a change in your way of writing?
I'm not sure that they are related. I think that indeed, after a certain age, I wasn't that needy on writing those bread and butter pieces that you have to write at the beginning of your career or starve. Even though many writers very honorably refused to do it from the very beginning, Mavis Gallant refused from the beginning to write something that you didn't want to write. Rohinton Mystery, for instance, today, and I can give many examples, but I wasn't that brave. So, at a certain point, I felt that I could write more of what I wanted to write rather than what I had to write because it was being paid for. And I think that the writing of fiction is perhaps connected to that, but I would say that it's more connected to something that happened in my idea of what I could do professionally. I started to write as an adolescent, as everybody does in the adolescence. And very soon I realized, as most people realize in their adolescence, that what I was writing is rubbish. And so that I would never put my writing next to the authors that I loved. And I felt an enormous relief. Borges, whom I knew in my adolescence, told me, a writer writes what he can, but a reader reads what he wants. And I thought, why give up that extraordinary freedom in order to write? Why not just remain on the other side of the page and be a reader for the rest of my life? And I was very happy for the longest time. But what I didn't know then and what I know now is that reading almost always leads to writing, that readers perform their task in the privacy of what Keats called the amorous space that a reader creates with his book. But then when you finish reading, and especially when you finish reading something you like, you want to grab a friend by the lapel and say, you have to read this, you don't you know that? And so it becomes communal, it becomes a dialogue, it becomes something that you want to share with others. And when I came to Canada, having read stories in different languages, I realized that my friends couldn't read the stories I had read because they hadn't been translated into English. So I started translating some stories and putting together anthologies. So these were my first books. So I still wasn't writing. I wrote introductions, but still I was a reader. And then with Gianni Guadalupe, shortly before that, when I was working for a publisher in Italy, we were in our 20s. And Gianni came one day to me and said, I have read this wonderful French novel by Paul Féval, The Vampire City. Why don't we write a travel guide to The Vampire City? And so I thought it was great fun, and we started to write that, not inventing anything, just taking all the elements that were in the novel, where to sleep, or rather, where not to sleep, or what to eat, etc., etc. And then we said, why limit ourselves to one city? Well, why not choose cities from literature and so on? And it ended up being this enormous dictionary of imaginary places, a big fat thing that is helpful to keep doors open. And that also came out of reading.
You read thousands of books for
thousands
that.
Of books, yeah. The complete Tarzan Zaga, 28 novels of the adventures of Tarzan, and the wonderful 17th century and 18th century utopias and so on, imaginary travel. And so that came out of reading, and then after that, the history of reading, which was a way of finding out what it was that we do. Because it occurred to me that in school I had always been taught that the history of literature depended on the writers, that the writers appeared and wrote their books and belonged to certain schools, and that you studied them in this official order. But it occurred to me that's not really how it happens. I mean, every writer wants his or her book to be a classic, and if they had their wish, we would have histories of literature would be so colossal that nobody, not even the Library of Alexandria, could hold them. But instead, what happens is that we, the readers, choose what should belong to the history of literature, what consists of schools or tendencies or even genres. And nothing the writer can do can affect that decision. I mean, the writer can't come up to you, Gillian, and say, oh, please like that book, please like, you should laugh. On there's another passage of Alice in Wonderland where the gnat keeps whispering in her ear, well, you could make a joke about that. And Alice ends up furious and says, well, if you are so keen on jokes, why don't you make them yourself? But the writer can't do that. The reader decides. And the reader decides that, for instance, in spite of Jonathan Swift having wanted to write a fierce political satire, that it's a children's book and puts Gulliver's Travels on the shelf. Well, I don't know where you put it in the library, but the shelf with a children's book. And that led to a history of reading, and then after that I thought, but reading is not just reading words, it's reading images, so I wrote reading pictures, and then I decided to show how reading affected my life, how reading was not, as we are told, something that pulls you away from reality, but that reading is something that plunges your nose into reality. And so I wrote The Reading Diary, which follows my reading of 12 books through a year and shows...
Very mixed with your own life.
Of course, because it does. I mean, nobody reads in isolation of his or her life. What you read affects how you live, what your opinions are, how you act. So all these books came from my reading. But then I wrote my first novel, which was News from a Foreign Country Came, and I wrote it to explain a terrible event in the history of Argentina around the dictatorship that I wanted to understand. And because books have always given me the words to ask the questions that would be meaningful for me, I decided when I had this question that I didn't know how to frame, that I would write a novel in order to have the frame for the question. The problem is that when you start to write fiction, it becomes a sort of addiction. In spite of all the good advice that I had given myself about not writing rubbish that would not fit on the shelf with my favorite authors, I began to write novel after novel because I wanted to tell a story. And now it's too late.
There are award-winning books also. Your most recent novel... Todos los hombres son mentirosos, or all men are liars in English. You appear as a character in that book, and again, the
pompous ass.
That is it. The second chapter starts with a statement of
Alberto Manguel is an asshole.
The second chapter, it's a very, very funny book, at least at the beginning. And in this book, you appear, and you have... It's again, playing with layers of reality, versions of reality, unreality, all of that. But again, this issue of the past of Argentina is again there. Mm-hmm. And so that's still something that you're exploring, the émigrés point of view.
You see, I was born in Argentina. I left when I was 1 month old. My father was the first ambassador to Israel, so I spent the first 7 years of my life in Israel. We returned when I was eight, And I went to school in Buenos Aires, and then I left immediately after my high school. So just when the military dictatorship was beginning, but of course all my friends went through that horrible decade.
Some were very involved.
Very involved. Well, you had to be involved because your choice was either to be a hypocrite and pretend that nothing was happening or carry a gun. You didn't have the choice. I fortunately was out of that because I don't know that I could have carried a gun, so I don't know what I would have done. But however, it struck me that after the military dictatorship, because Argentina wasn't willing to confront the torturers and the murderers, unlike Germany, the President Menem, for instance, had declared an amnesty for these torturers and murderers. Argentinian history, that story that we tell that is history, had a gap, had a missing chapters if someone had ripped the pages out of the middle of the book. And the next generations, the generations of my nephews and nieces, didn't know where to start. They had the 19th century, they had the early 20th century, and then they had their lives in the almost the 21st century. What happened in between? Now they have been taken to court, and the problems of Argentina are others. Argentina has not solved its problems. But however, at the time, I wanted to write about that gap. What happens when you pretend that the memory of a tragic moment is deleted, erased? And I wrote this novel about a character who's dead, supposedly an Argentinian novelist, interviewed by a French journalist, a French journalist who goes to interview people who have known him, and so receives different portraits of that man, which are contradictory or complementary. And with that, try to build the image of something, much as the image of Argentina had to be built through that essential missing part. And so I wrote All Men Are Liars.
You write also about reading as in a book, a recent book about the traveler, the tower, and the worm, mm-hmm. which is about reader as metaphor. And you talk about the traveler is the reader who is then, it's a recognition of the world. It's a learning of the self, it's a learning of the world. And, you know, so through these books, these parts of the world can be recovered, they can be internalized, they can go along. But you say also that the reader as traveler is a metaphor that you think is no longer always hold. And what do you mean by that?
I wrote this book because I wanted to investigate what is the language that we use to speak of reading in literate societies, because I had the suspicion that whatever vocabulary we chose, whatever metaphors we chose to speak of reading, reflected on what that society thought of reading. And for instance, in Western societies, for instance, today, the intellectual act has no prestige whatsoever. So what are the metaphors? How do we speak of reading when we say reading is important, everybody should read, campaigns for reading? But essentially, we think that reading is not important and that what we should be doing is playing video games, which is what the industry is putting forward. Why waste time with something that's difficult and slow? So I was looking at these metaphors, and the metaphor of the traveler, which stems from a very old metaphor of the world as book and the book as world. So when you look at the book as world, when you read the text, you are traversing the text as if you were undertaking a voyage. Saint Augustine, who is one of the ones who has written with most intelligence about reading and the act of reading, he speaks at some point of reading a psalm that he knows, and going from the territory of memory, which when you begin is very small, it appears in this metaphor as a small stretch of land, and in front of you extends the territory of the text, which you have to cross. But as you begin to traverse the territory of the text, the territory of memory increases. And so while the text becomes shorter because you are reading it, your memory captures the text and increases. And it's a metaphor of traveling through the text from one end to the other.
You have two other metaphors in the book. One is the tower, yeah. The ivory tower. In some senses, it's a withdrawal from the world that's well seen, and in other senses,
yes.
It's poorly seen.
Yes, this is a metaphor that, again, it's very old. It appears in the Bible, has been used by Seneca, but not as the ivory tower. They speak about the ivory tower, but not in the sense of the writer of the ivory tower. The materialization of this metaphor comes from Sainte-Beuve when he's speaking about Lamartine, and speaking about Lamartine in praising him for being in his ivory tower where he can write his poetry, not as distancing him from the affairs of the world, but going to a place where real poetry can be produced. And that metaphor has been taken to mean that the writer does not take part of the public affairs, of the affairs of society, but withdraws and doesn't look at society and becomes an elitist figure. So these metaphors can be used according to how society deals with the question. They are, I will repeat myself, more indicative of what society, what the user feels about reading than about reading itself. Mm.
You have an amazing lack of snobbery in your reading. You have in your reading diary, you have at some places your reading lists, and you have such an eclectic range of reading of classical authors with contemporary mystery novels and things like that. And you talk about, you can bring
Speak
together...
Speak not lightly of the mystery novel.
No, I never would. And you're able to see across this. On the one hand, you say that the reading, the juxtaposition of texts or of thinkers affects your reading.
Of course.
And you're able to see across them, so you can see a common... the pain of existence as common in Sherlock Holmes and Faust, in Goethe's Faust, and you draw these things out. And I think, on the one hand, you are partly responsible for creating anthologies and giving us anthologies of some of the voices that were more marginal before we got them. And at the same time, you refer to what we would call the core canon of literary history, and you range over them with equal interest and equal sense of these people having ideas to be represented. And I wonder how you what you think can be said to young people who are they're reading, they're in school, they're studying, they want to connect with their contemporary worlds, and they want to acknowledge marginal voices. They don't want to be limited, and there's a lot of bad press around the canon these days. And so the canon is,
This comes again from this sin of labeling. As soon as you label something, you close it in, you put walls around it, and then you make it privileged or exclusive and unappealing, because literature is appealing because it's personal, because you discover it. You can't force someone to fall in love. So it is true that I can read Homer, I can read Conan Doyle with the same pleasure. And I think that we make a mistake when we confuse high literature, the canon, with popular genres, and we forget that the canon was a popular genre. That is to say, that soldiers enjoyed reading the Iliad and the novels of chivalry, as Don Quixote tells us, they were read in inns and so on. So the idea of canon as something outside popular reading is false. Canon, as you know as a librarian, is the creation of librarians in Alexandria to help readers, to say, okay, you can't read all of Greek literature, so we'll help you recommending some titles, and we'll produce annotated catalogs that were called canons. But the mistake comes in confusing the popular with that which is not profound. Some popular literature is not profound and won't allow any reader to go beneath the surface, because there's nothing there. Dan Brown's The Da Vinci Code can be read from the first to the last page, but doesn't allow for a profound reading. On the other hand, many science fiction novels, many horror novels, many detective novels, many romances are as well literature that allows this profound reading. And I would say, taking the example further, that many of the books that are in the canon, for me, don't allow a profound reading. So I put them, if not next to the Da Vinci Code, very, very close. Gustave Doré, when he was 17, made a list of the books, the classic books that he wanted to illustrate before the end of his life, and he illustrated most of them. But among the list, the Bible, the Odyssey, Dante's Commedia, etc., Rabelais, was Oliver Goldsmith, the Vicar of Wakefield. And so I tried to read it, but I couldn't get into it. I felt that it was a superficial book. Now, people will throw stones at me for saying this, but I put it among those books that don't have that scope for me, that are not for me. And this is something that Borges taught me, to have the right of choice. That doesn't mean that you have the right to consider yourself stupid and not worthy of a book. You're worthy of any book. Any book. That's one of the first things that I would tell a young reader. But you also have the right of saying this book is not for me. You know, again, you'll throw stones at me. Stendhal is not one of my favorite writers. I could live without Stendhal. And I know that for many people, his books are essential, not for me. And so we all create our private libraries with our darlings and our friends and our comrades and our teachers. And the library is very personal, and your library won't coincide with mine. But it's important that it be personal, because at cocktail parties, you might need to say that you have read the latest novel by the latest Nobel Prize winner. But when you are at home, in the dark, with your fears and your suffering, those books won't come and console you. That private library that you reluctantly share with others, that library is going to be your refuge and your consolation.
It's a beautiful thought. Perhaps that's a moment when we should see if there are any questions from the floor, in the room. Yes.
And mostly David Lang, the management. Many of the people that you have referred to in your extraordinary talk lived in those imaginary places because they weren't real people. How is it that historic figures seem to have impact that is rather short-lived, whereas these important people who never lived go on forever? Who were the most important people for you who never lived?
I think what you say is absolutely true, because 99% of the politicians who are in the news today, of the bureaucrats who harry our lives, of the notable figures in People magazine, will disappear before the night is over, while Don Quixote, Gregor Samsa, Huckleberry Finn, Anne of Green Gables, etc., 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 will live forever, because we say that they are imaginary, but we mean imaginary in the sense that they are rooted in our imagination. The French have this wonderfully useful word, imaginaire, which is the collection of symbols and dreams and icons that we all share to create what we call a society. Well, these characters are the inhabitants of our imaginaire, and that imaginaire, it is much more stronger. It's much stronger. My English falls apart at this time of the evening. That imaginaire is much stronger than our petty identities of Quebecois or Canadian or North American or European or this or that. No one can say that the Quixote is an exclusively Spanish character. For Dostoevsky, he was Russian. For Ismail Kadare, he's Albanian. And so, to answer your question, yes, you are absolutely right. They are more alive than anyone who is truly alive.
Another question? Yes?
Do you still prefer reading
Yes, yes. I enjoy writing, but, and this is not false modesty, I know I don't do it well enough. Partly because every creative task, everything that we build, if it is to be successful, it contains a large degree of failure. Only the works that don't matter are perfect. Many of the bestsellers that we read about are perfect, built on a certain formula. Certain kinds of music are perfect. They belong in an elevator. And the McDonald produces perfectly round hamburgers. But real creation entails failure. And it is through that failure that the reader has access to the work. Robert Louis Stevenson said this marvelous thing, that our mission in life is not to succeed, but to continue to fail in the best of spirits.
Question there.
I was looking at your website, as I frequently do, and I've called a number of times.
A website that I haven't built, but friends have put together, so you will have to tell me about it.
Right. Well, I recommend all of you look at the website. Simply see that Alberto speaks everywhere. In the past month, he was in Barcelona, Madeira, Madrid, New York, God knows where else. But I have a question. In your calendar, there's a mention of something you're doing with the Bibliothèque Archive National de Québec. Could you maybe just talk a little bit about it?
This was a wonderful gift of the Bibliothèque Nationale du Québec. They are celebrating their 50th, I think, anniversary this year. Somebody corrected me? 10th anniversary. it will be 50th, but it's 10th anniversary. And a couple of years ago, they approached me to ask me if I would be agreeable for them to set up an exhibit around one of my books, The Library at Night. And I said, of course. Well, it turns out that this little exhibit is going to be a production by Robert Lepage, which is going to entail the visit to 12 of the world's greatest libraries, through three-dimensional goggles that visitors will wear. And I have seen one of the episodes, and it is unbelievable, because it's really like living in a hallucination. You visit the Vatican Library, you walk through the Vatican Library, people talk to you, you almost can touch the books. So this is going to happen in October, and you're all invited.
Is there another question?
What do you hope for your books that you're writing?
For the books that I'm writing?
The question is,
you're writing, what do you hope for? What do you want to happen to it?
Thomas Love Peacock, who's one of my favorite novelists of the 19th century, says in one novel, he has a character who is a novelist who has just published a novel and who discovers that 7 copies have been sold. And he says, 7 copies, 7 readers, these will be the 7 candles that will light my world. I'm hoping for 7 readers.
There's a question at the back there.
Hi, I was just wondering, you've already done a lot of reading, but there's still a lot of reading to do. Do you ever feel overwhelmed by how much reading there still is to do?
As an adolescent, I felt the anxiety of the libraries, the anxiety of walking into a library or a bookstore and saying, my goodness, how many riches, and I will never be able to read them all, and what if I miss something important? With age, there is a kind of relief in the knowledge that you will not read everything, that you don't have to read everything. And it is with immense joy that I say to myself, the list of bestsellers of this week has 20 titles that I will never, ever open. And I prefer to reread, because in rereading, I feel like visiting old friends. I travel too much and I meet too many people. And I long for what I call the veranda and the rocking chair, except that it's inside a library, my own, visited by old friends like Stevenson or Montaigne or Dante or Lewis Carroll, whose habits I know, whose voice is familiar. I don't have to ask them whether they want coffee or tea. I know what side of the bed they sleep on. and so we begin immediately in the middle of the conversation. There are no superficial surprises. I know that Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde are the same person. I know who the murderer of Roger Ackroyd is. But then I can enjoy a different kind of conversation. And this is what I continue to look forward now.
Are you ever disappointed when you've recommended a lapel-grabbing novel or story to somebody and they look at you and they think, well, I didn't enjoy it?
Of course. And then I can be drastic. I can stop being friends with that person. Not for every book, but there are certain books that if you don't like, I feel that we can have a polite acquaintance, but we will never be friends. If you don't like Alice in Wonderland or Nicholas Blake or Emily Dickinson, I'm sorry.
You are speaking earlier. You were speaking earlier about our identities, you know, how we can have so many labels and so many selves attached. And I was reminded of Fernando Pessoa, the author of the Book of Disquiet, was very, very alone all through his life, always living in the same place, but who created all these personas throughout his life. I think it was about 20 or 25 personas throughout his life that he wrote through. And I was thinking, if you're writing about imaginary places, could you make a dictionary of all the alter egos of writers and all the imaginary people that were created?
I think the dictionary exists. There is a dictionary of pseudonyms, of alter egos. And it makes for fascinating reading because the huge differences sometimes between the character that the writer creates and the writer, him or herself. In the case of Pessoa, it was extraordinary because there were so many and so different. You can recognize the voice of Reis or whoever it is as a different character. But yes, it's a wonderfully amusing thought.
Yes, everybody look at the website. Thank you so, so very much on behalf of the Friends of the Library. I'm sure you all join me in giving a tremendous round of thanks to Alberto and Jillian. It has been an amazing conversation, and I know you've given all of us a new way to look at, embrace, and analyze our own personal journey with reading. We're all going to go home and think about it and have a whole new way of rethinking and enjoying our way forward with our reading. So thank you so very much.
Thank you.
We have a small gift here on behalf of McGill. And also, we'll think about it as a slightly early birthday present, because the birdie told us it's your birthday tomorrow. So thank you very, very much for this.
Can I open it now?
Oh, you may. And while you're opening it, and just before we let everyone free to go and enjoy a... Oh, he's got a... No, there's two presents. There you go. One is
it's
a thing.
It's not a book.
It's not a book.
Thank you.
Our great pleasure. I just wanted to remind everyone about our next event for Friends of the Library. I know you enjoyed this one. Hopefully you will enjoy the next one, which will take place on the 28th of April, in about a month and a half. It is our Hugh McLennan Memorial Lecture, which will take place, as I say, on the 28th of April. A venue still to be determined. But we are going to be having as our guest lecturer Sarah McLaughlin, who is president of Anansi Press. And she is going to be talking about the state and challenges of the publishing industry in Canada in this digital age, which should make for a very fascinating evening. So I do hope that you will want to join us for that. If you are a member of the Friends of the Library, you will be getting further notification, reminder of the evening, and we'll tell you where it is. If you're not a friend of the library, we have pamphlets at the back inviting you to join. So I do invite you to pick one up and hope that you will join us. So without further ado, thank you again to both Alberto and Jillian, and invite all of you to join us for a glass of wine at the back. Thanks very much.